Another thing just to distribute is a copy of a lecture that I had prepared for last week, since I didn't give you a handout on that. I was asked if I would do that, so this is it. That's just last week's lecture. And then the final thing is this week's.
Thank you.
So, this is the material for today. Oh, you've already got it. I gave you yours yesterday. So, there we go. All right. So, then I'm back to following my normal style of lecture, and I will. Does everybody have this done? We'll just use this as a basis, but it's not a matter that we have to read the whole thing or anything like that. But this is a way that I found successful at lecturing in the past, is to have the notes in the students' hands and then start by reading it, but then we can start moving around and you can interrupt me at any point. So our reading this week is the section Philosophy of God and Theology in this book. So it's beginning on page 159 and we're going to about 218, I think. Yes, 218. Where Lonergan is making a basic proposal that the old conception... I think the thing that I want to emphasize from the beginning of this is that this proposal is not something that he would have been prepared to offer at the time of Insight. In terms of the stages of development that I went through last week, it was only once he began to realize that really what grounds all discourse on God is religious experience that he would come up with this kind of proposal. Before that, the philosophy of God followed upon other philosophical considerations in Insight before he raised any question about religious experience or revelation or a theology that comes from revelation. There is this natural theology that he speaks about in chapter 19 of Insight. Completely not only distinct, but also separate from anything that flows from revelation, faith, love, religious experience, community, and so on. A purely rational intellectual exercise demonstrating the existence of the unrestricted act of understanding. So that's the old approach to the philosophy of God. Not only distinct from systematic theology, and understood as something that is an attempt to understand the mysteries of faith, completely distinct from that, but also separated from it, not even needing it, not being put into that context, as if, you know, the book could have stopped at the end of chapter 19. Okay, there's a God, big deal, okay? But this, he's now suggesting, because of this movement to the priority and primacy of love, and in the religious sphere, religious love, as having, holding the primacy, and religious experience as being the source of all of our, or at least most of our questions about God, and certainly the basic question about God, as he'll say here, is the one that flows from some kind of religious experience, there's a shift that is needed in terms of these disciplines of philosophy of God and theology. So the basic proposal is that the old conception of the relationship between philosophy of God and systematics is to be set aside. That is, the conception that the two are not only distinct but also separated. There's a kind of, as I say down below here in the end of number two, there's a kind of seamless whole that you have in the Summa of Aquinas between philosophical and theological considerations. And Lonergan wants to restore that kind of seamless whole, but obviously not in the sense of simply repeating what's in Thomas, because we have to do it for our own context. And that means that we have to transpose whatever is permanently valid in Aquinas into our own context. And so we have to do it in our own context. And even Aquinas himself did not begin with an exploration of religious experience. But I think what Lonergan is seeing is what many scholars of Aquinas are seeing now. Aquinas is through and through a theologian. And philosophy comes into his work and it's really very serious philosophy, but it comes into his work as a dimension of his theology. And it's from the philosophical work that he's incorporated, largely but not exclusively from Aristotle, that he derives the general categories of his theology, that is to say, categories that were shared at his time with other disciplines, with psychology, with physics, as in whatever form physics was in those days. But Aristotle wrote a book called Physics. It was a cosmology. So philosophy is what gave Aquinas the general categories of the theology. But it's not true, for instance, and I think in Verbum, Lonergan was still presupposing that it was true, that in the Summa Theologiae, the first 26 questions are all philosophical. And then he gets into the Trinity. So the first 26 questions are all the philosophy of God, completely outside any theological context. And only then does he start raising the question of, well, how are we to understand this Christian thing about there being three persons in God? And it is now pretty much common currency, I think, among scholars of Thomas that that is not the case. That the book is theological from the beginning. And it presupposes a faith context from the beginning. And he's not arguing philosophically without the theological context. It is a Summa Theologiae, a summary of theology, an overview of theology. And so it's not as though... There's a statement that Lonergan has in Verbum that the material on the Trinity that starts with question 27 in the Summa is simply a prolongation of natural theology. He wouldn't say that now. See, he wouldn't say that, well, natural theology is completely independent of the faith context. So you do all of that first, and then you extend it over into the Trinity, and only then do you rely on faith and the community's tradition and so on for your categories. He would not say that any longer. It is rather that the philosophy of God is part of what you use to try to understand the God that you believe in as a Christian, who is a triune God. So you're incorporating that philosophy of God into Trinitarian theology from the beginning. It's not as though the treatise on the Trinity is a prolongation of what we know by natural reason, but rather, within the whole framework of the theology, we use natural reason as well as reason illumined by faith to speak about God. But I did hear, and I think this is indicative of the novelty of this and the fact that a lot of this major shift in Lonergan's thinking in his last years has not yet caught on among his students, because I did hear one fairly reputable Lonergan scholar at a lecture a couple of years ago quoting the statement from Verbum that the treatise on the Trinity is a prolongation of natural theology. Well, that was something Lonergan said 60 years ago. But it is not something that he would have said 25 years ago. In other words, there is a change there. And the context has changed, and the place where he would put philosophical reflection about God has changed. It's not now something that comes prior to doing anything theologically. It's something that comes within the framework of doing something theologically. That you can use philosophy to answer the question of God, but in all likelihood, the question of God has arisen, not necessarily, but in all likelihood, has arisen out of some kind of religious dimension of your life, and not out of a purely philosophical dimension. Yes, Robbie.
So, Bob, you would say that so philosophy of God then takes place within the context of religious experience, but would you say, is he also suggesting that it would have to be, for instance, a Christian theological interpretation, or that would have to be the context, or it's just religious experience?
I think it's, in certainly in his own doing it, it would be a Christian. But it's an interesting thing that when he speaks about religious conversion, he's not using Christian categories. He's saying religious conversion is being flooded with this experience of the love of God. What Christianity, and that, he says, is found in Christianity and elsewhere. And what Christianity does is to give some categories for understanding that experience in the context, intersubjectively. There is the Holy Spirit as a category naming a person in God who is given to us in this gift of love. And it names Jesus Christ as one of the senders of the Holy Spirit, and the one whose outer word clarifies this inner word of love that we experience religiously. But he's not saying that it has to be within that context that it has to be done. Because the religious experience that he's talking about, he got into trouble in this first lecture for saying this, in the responses afterwards, for saying this religious experience that he's talking about is not exclusive to Christianity. It is found elsewhere as well. And there was an interchange there that got a little sharp, because whoever it was that was questioning him just couldn't accept that, and was falling back on a reading of the Bible that said that it had to be within this context. And, Lonergan's appealing to a more general experience, and I think also to a more general exigence. By this time, he had already read Heiler's essay, not everybody follows Heiler on everything, but where Heiler is basically saying that there's an awful lot, that there is something that is commonly found in a number of religious traditions, and it is this love that prompts people to self-transcendent behavior.
But this is post-Vatican II.
Oh, this is way post-Vatican II.
So it already said in Vatican II, it recognizes that the Holy Spirit is present.
Yeah, but see, it takes a while for people to catch up with those things. And if you look at that response of the question and answer session here at the background, page 176. Yeah, the question there that starts the first full question. In your lecture, when you discuss religious consciousness, which you define roughly as grace or the result of grace, you do that chiefly with reference to the Bible, but it seems to me that despite the implications of your exegesis of the passages that you cite, the Bible would deny that there is a genuine religious consciousness apart from the revelation which it itself constitutes. Thus, it seems to me that the Bible would deny the possibility of the philosophy of God on your definition. That is something that flows out of religious experience. So Lonergan says, well, what about the first epistle to Timothy, chapter 2, verse 4, God wills all people to be saved? And then the exegesis you give is the traditional Roman Catholic fundamental theological exegesis. But I think you'd be hard put to find that to be the genuine significance of that verse in any kind of literal sense. Paul is not really thinking that there must be grace bestowed on all people. Lonergan says, I'm just stating what is said there. Question, God wills the salvation of all people, and thus he has sent his son to save the world. But Paul says in other places that unless the gospel of Christ is preached and unless the gospel is believed, all people will not be saved. So God is not providing the salvation of all people in any other way than to send his son to whom the salvation of the world is owed. Lonergan, this is typical of Lonergan when you get it. Well, that's another view, isn't it? The typical response, And then he says, but Paul has to say about charity that there isn't salvation without it, and there is lots of evidence of people leading extremely good lives without being Christians. So they go back and forth, and they never reached any agreement. So it goes on for another half page there, and it's just a different mindset on this. And it's obviously, it's still with us today. And it's not clear, because if you look at the problems that Father Dupuis ran into, for instance, with his book on Christianity and the World Religion, I forget the name of the book, but he wasn't saying anything different from and certainly nothing more radical than things that could have been found in the writings of John Paul II in terms of the presence of the Holy Spirit outside of Christianity. But there were others in the Vatican who probably were afraid to take on John Paul II, but they could get at this by taking on this humble old Jesuit who was teaching at the Gregorian. And they did, you know, but then they, there's a story about this that I heard. Do you know the story about his defense? Was where did I hear this? They had an interview with Cardinal Ratzinger, when Ratzinger was still head of the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith. Father Kolbenbach, the general of the Jesuits, Father Dupuis, and Father Gerald O'Collins, an Australian Jesuit teaching theology of the Gregorian. And O'Collins was the official defender of Father Dupuis vis-a-vis the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith. So the three of them met with Ratzinger. And ahead of time, Father Kolbenbach said to Father Dupuis, "Now you just remain quiet. Father O'Collins will speak for you." So Father O'Collins takes Dupuis' book and he opens it to a certain paragraph. And he says, "Now this paragraph, Cardinal Ratzinger, is one of the paragraphs for which Father Dupuis has been attacked. I would suggest that if you read the paragraph that comes before it, this paragraph and the paragraph that follows it, you will see that there is no reason to attack Father Dupuis for this paragraph." So Cardinal Ratzinger starts reading, and he starts blushing as he's reading, embarrassed blushing. And he finishes reading the three paragraphs, and he says, "Case dismissed. There is no problem with this book." That's it. Which means a lot, you know. I mean, in terms of, like, he didn't really do his homework. He had others doing it for him. Yeah. But it also means that these issues are still very hot and not easily people are still uncomfortable. A lot of people probably would still not be comfortable with what Lonergan's saying here, even though he's not saying anything more than John Paul II said either in terms of genuine religion outside of Christianity. Anyway, I carried away with a response to your question, but no, I mean, I think he's thinking of it in terms of, I should qualify what I said here, because he's speaking of it in a context that has to do with what's the relationship of philosophy of God with the theological functional specialty systematics. Now, systematics, as he would understand it, is understood within the framework of Christian theology. So it's an attempt to understand the mysteries of Christian faith. But there's a generic meaning to systematics as well. That there would be a Jewish systematics, there would be a Muslim systematics, there would be a Hindu systematics, because the functional specialties can be employed all over the place. And also outside of theology, functional specialty structure is a structure for certainly all of the humane sciences, all of the humane disciplines. And so when a Muslim says what he or she believes in doctrines, then the next step is to say how one understands that, and that's what systematics is. So I think what this would apply across the board, what he's saying about the relationship here between the two, that it's within the faith context that the philosophy of God makes sense. I think that's the main thing that he's trying to say, that the philosophy of God doesn't make sense outside of a context that is influenced already by some kind of religious commitment. So, and then there's this appeal that he makes. I'm jumping all over the place, but that's okay. We're hitting most of the issues as we're doing this. There's this appeal that he makes to, he makes it here, and he's made it in Method and Theology, and he makes it in his paper, The Natural Knowledge of God. Vatican I did say that it is possible to demonstrate the existence of God. But the earlier version of that statement said it is possible for people in the fallen state of, even in the fallen state of human nature, to demonstrate the existence of God, and they scrapped that phrase. Which for Lonergan means that it is only within the context of grace and religious experience that philosophy of God makes any sense. And that even the demonstrations, which, there was one point where Lonergan said, it may have been in here, I've been reading so much, but where, you know, it really isn't hard to demonstrate that God exists. It's not all that difficult. But it doesn't make any sense outside of a particular horizon. And if you're not within that horizon, you're not going to buy the argument. And I think that, you know, I think this is the case with a lot of statements of that have religious connections to them, that they don't make sense outside of the horizon of at least being open to some kind of relationship to a transcendent being, personal relationship.
I'm a bit worried about this because one of the possible problems with that, I'm not saying that this is where you can go, but one of the possible interpretations of that, I think, or use of that, if you emphasize contextual theology and you bring in, hermeneutics and some of the applied postmodern forces today. What happens is that then you say, okay, if you cannot do a philosophy of God outside of a faith horizon, which means, okay, we speak of a religious experience, you're already speaking of a religious experience that is already interpreted within a horizon. So it is really only either a Christian horizon or a Buddhist horizon or a Hindu horizon and so on. So it is out of that affirmation then, if I understand Lonergan correctly, you do engage in systematics as a reflection on that, and therefore you make use of philosophy of God to help to... So philosophy of God and systematics work hand in hand in order to try to understand that doctrinal position already. If you do that, there could be contemporary forces, I think, that would emphasize, well, then there are only particular positions from out of which, therefore, you can do a philosophy of God or systematics, and there's no transcendent base such as a religious experience, because it's always a particular religious experience, whether it's point of view from a Hindu or a Christian, and so on.
I think I understand what you're saying. Sorry. Okay, but then you're at where your problem there is heading, at least if it's not even focused on it, is the interpretation of religious experience itself. And there are at least two schools. There's the Katz school, K-A-T-Z, Stephen Katz, who would want to argue against there being anything in common from one tradition to another, that they're all particular traditions and there isn't anything in common. And Lonergan is not, he's following another school of religious followers. Now, why is he? Well, it certainly helps him theologically if they're right, that there is something in common, even though it's not going to be named the same way. When we get to the paper, Prolegomenon to the Study of the Emerging Religious Consciousness of Our Time, he will say, we don't have the language yet to talk cross faith-wise about this experience. And so the only I can do, he says, is to do the best I can with the language that I have for my tradition. But there's a language that has to emerge yet, and will only emerge out of the dialogue of the traditions with each other. And until that point, the different traditions can only use their own language. But as they do that, if they're really in dialogue with each other, can they open each other up to what the underlying experience is that they're talking about through these categories? But I think that's where the difficulty would be.
There are some who would push that all the way to the extreme and say, well, you can emphasize radical contextual theology and then really it's difficult to engage in a dialogue that, that allows you to say, well, there's a common ground here, I can come to that. No, it's different. The tradition of East is different, yours is different. Why I'm thinking of this also is because I'm wondering if I'm understanding Longin correctly, he wants to bring the philosophy of God into theology.
Right.
A lot of, one of the things that I am concerned about is how you would bring theology, faith, or let's say the religious experience into a philosophical context and do it the other way around and say that philosophy is incapable of attaining what it wants, its goal, unless it takes into consideration this transcendent base that is there. And I think when he speaks of the person, he really brings that out for philosophy, I think.
Yeah, he does, but it's going to be a lot harder to convince philosophy departments of that than it is to convince theology departments that they could use a little philosophy. At least that's what he's saying. And that theology departments in universities, for instance, certainly the universities that I've been, will be happy to incorporate some philosophical reflection into their theology. But you go the other way around, and even with in Catholic universities, they may say, "Well, that's theology. We know we're not. You know, we're doing this purely independently." And even committed Catholic professors will say, well, you know, I may believe all of that stuff, but that's not what I'm doing as a professor of philosophy. But what you're saying is also true. It's what Addo says in terms of philosophy as a way of life, that little book that he wrote about Greek philosophy, which I know secondhand, mainly through talking to Gilles Morneau about it. But Eric Vogel is saying the same thing, that philosophy began as an opening of the soul to transcendence, which for Vogelin was a form of revelation and grace, independently of outside the Judeo-Christian tradition. And he makes eminent sense when he says that. He makes eminent sense of that when he says, to me, it makes eminent sense that there is, that this is what's behind philosophy in Greece, is this disclosure of the world transcendent good drawing us to itself, whatever that is, you know. That does make tremendous sense.
See, that is very, I don't want to say Eastern or Asian, because that's an abstract construct, but at least from my own understanding of Indian philosophy, that's why it's called the darshanas, the vision, but that's what it is. It's an opening up. It's theological, that therefore you make use of philosophical reasoning in order to understand, but it doesn't exhaust everything.
That's right.
So,
well, I think by and large you're saying the same thing as he's saying, but I think he would say in response, well, it's probably easier to do all of that in a theology context than it might be in a philosophical context. I don't know. I'm not sure. I remember when I was taking philosophy under this old system, and you'll see this when you read the notes, where obviously we're not going to get through all of my notes, and we don't have to. It's only a base to take off from. When I was studying philosophy back in 1960 to 64 in St. Louis, well, we were definitely under this old system. And when we got to the philosophy of God, they abstracted. We didn't realize this at the time, but with some of the issues that they were discussing in philosophy of God, they were abstracting from the very context in which Aquinas himself dealt with those issues, which was a theological issue, a theological context. So, for instance, with the whole question of God's foreknowledge of what we're going to do, and predestination, and all of that sort of thing, they're dealing with that as a purely philosophical question. Aquinas never dealt with those things in that. It was always in the context of grace and freedom. It was a theological issue from the beginning, and then within that context, he presents a position with respect to those issues. And yet we were not allowed to bring in that context of grace, you know, because that was theology. Or the divine ideas in the philosophy of God, you know, the divine ideas in Aquinas are spoken in the word, You know, so it's in a Trinitarian context in Aquinas. They abstract it from that whole context. And so you get the impression of that there's this lonely supreme being thinking these ideas. That's not God, you know? That isn't God. That's not Aquinas' God, let alone my God. I'm not interested in a lonely old man sitting in heaven thinking ideas, you know? no matter how good the ideas are. The divine ideas are spoken in the divine word, in Aquinas. And so it's in the Trinitarian context that we should be dealing with, you know, what God knows. So, that kind of thing. So that's what he's trying to do. Put it back together, you know, like Humpty Dumpty. Put back together what centuries of conceptualism and static essentialism have divided. Let's put them back together. That's okay. Now, what I would like to do is to just look. All right. Bottom of page one. We can skip a lot of stuff, but what I'd like to do is to run through the stuff on the differentiations of consciousness, because what he's talking about. What you're going to find in most of the things that we're reading this semester is a different Lonergan as a writer, different from what you might be used to. If you've already read both Insight and Method, you know that there's a tremendous difference in style between the two books. That Insight is overwritten in some senses, and if he even thought of it while he was writing it, he said it. You know, it's like they said about Andrew Greeley, he's never had an unpublished thought. Well, everything that Lonergan thought at the time that he wrote Insight probably got into the book. But it's very verbose and it's very linear. It's, you know, in the first place, in the second place, in the third place, in the fourth place. And Method is more meditative, and deceptively easier to read. But deceptively, because it depends so much on everything that he did in Insight. And he's even more moving all over the place in these later writings. It's not that it's undisciplined, but it's not linear. It isn't linear the way his earlier, and especially Insight, was. So here, you know, the lecture is called Philosophy of God, but the main thing that he's talking about in the lecture are various cultural contexts. Because it's the various cultural contexts that determine where the philosophy of God fits in a curriculum or in a person's own understanding of the relationship between philosophy and theology and so on and so forth. And what's responsible for these cultural contexts? It's different differentiations of consciousness. So basically what this whole lecture is about is the differentiations of consciousness. And so if we turn to top of page 2, what has happened to render that separation no longer appropriate to a contemporary philosophical context? And then number 4, the answer is to be found in differentiations of consciousness. The meaning of the terms philosophy and God, I always get a joke out of the opening sentence here. Lecture 1, Philosophy of God. In this title, there are two words whose meaning is somewhat obscure. The first of these is philosophy, and the second is God. Well, what about of? You know, the meaning of of could be obscure, too, anyway. So, the meaning of the terms philosophy and God differs at different times and places. And the underlying fact of that difference is what I have named differentiations of consciousness. So, most of the first lecture is devoted to a discussion of various differentiations, because these will determine what is meant by philosophy of God at any one time. And some, at least, of the focus here is on language as indicative of different differentiations of consciousness. So he speaks of 5, and then he says there are more, and you know that in Insight he goes into more. He goes into art and into scholarship and... Then I've spoken of an incipient ecological differentiation in our time, and so on. But he will speak here of 5 of them. The first one is what happens in infancy when we start to learn to speak. There's a differentiation of consciousness that happens because when the child, the infant, learns language, the infant is all of a sudden catapulted into an enormously larger world. Because language can name not only what is here to be seen and touched and tasted and so on and so forth, but what is absent, what is distant, what is past, what is future, and so on. And so the world just expands exponentially with language, with the learning of language. We see that dramatically in the Helen Keller story, which is something that Lonergan appeals to frequently. This girl who lived exclusively in the world of immediacy until she was 9 years old, because she could not see, she could not hear. The senses were, all of the senses, practically except touch, were closed off to her. And then finally it was that she got the insight that a certain way in which her nurse was touched was meant something. Like, that means water. The nurse poured the water and at the same time went like this and she got it. So that was language for her. And then the world just expanded. And she lived then, from that point on, a life where she wrote books. And, you know, it's a whole different thing. But it was that moment that brought her out of the world of immediacy, exclusively living in the world of immediacy, and into the world mediated by meaning. The meaning of these signs opened a world to her.
So, Bob, how would we define meaning? Because I think I've thought of meaning as when we're able to reflect on our experience. And an infant learning language wouldn't necessarily be able to reflect on that.
No, there is elemental meaning.
Right.
And to use Lonergan's categories, the infant will experience elemental meaning in the mother's smile.
Mm-hmm.
All right? And it does make a difference to the infant.
Mm-hmm.
The mother's love does make a difference as it's communicated to the infant. And we know that by psychological studies as well as by common sense. But the infant is not conceptualizing that or anything like that. It's in its meaning at an elemental level that's already being communicated. Smiles and scowls and soft voice and loud voice and all of that. It's elemental meaning contained in all of that. So there is meaning moves through all the levels of consciousness, but there's elemental meaning even at that primal experiential level. And then language, the world, there is meaning then in this sense, there is meaning even in the world of immediacy for the infant in the sense in which the mother is communicating something, or not just the mother, but I think it is primarily the bond of mother and child at the beginning, is communicating something. It's almost like the mother is saying, you belong here, or something like that. And she wants to communicate that. She means to communicate that. But with the expansion that comes with learning language, one is introduced to being able to... one's world becomes more than what one immediately is experiencing. And so then there's a world that is mediated through symbol, through story, why stories are so important to children. My niece used to keep saying, tell us a story, tell me another story, But it's the world, the stories could be fantastic, but it's mediating something about the world. So that's a first differentiation of consciousness. Then he speaks about, and this is something that he only began to talk about, I think, in these terms after method and theology, that there's this, he'll speak of this as a literary differentiation, the second one there. And I think at one point in these lectures he does use that terminology. But there's a further differentiation that occurs when one learns a language rich and varied and supple enough to portray people in all their complexity. So we can grow in this use of language. and you know, so that we can develop ways of understanding the subtleties and nuances and so on. And for Lonergan in the Western tradition, this is, was done in the literature of the Greeks, Greek tragedy, poetry, and so on. And it is a fantastic body of literature. And then there's the shift from ordinary and literary language to the technical language of science. This began in, with Aristotle. Well, it began with, well, in the West, with questions, not necessarily began, there may have been others who raised, I think speculative questions have always been raised by people. But it was Socrates who wanted definitions. What do you mean? What is justice? Can you define it? And as Lonergan says frequently, you know, the people knew what was just and unjust, but they couldn't define justice. You know, they knew when injustice was being done. But Socrates was looking for definitions, and a couple of generations later, Aristotle started providing definitions. So there's this breakthrough to a kind of systematic control of meaning. And then, of course, it worked its way through metaphysics, through the philosophy, and particularly Aristotle is much more systematic in his philosophy than Plato. And then down, it really didn't come into Christian tradition until the 12th and 13th centuries, is when in the second lecture he'll go through the development of Christian theology. But there is that shift. And then, of course, in modern science, it takes on a new meaning because the system is no longer considered to be permanently valid, universal, necessary, the way it was in a classicist framework, but rather there are ongoing systems in modern philosophy. So we will no longer think of systematic theology in a theological context either as an achievement that once it's achieved, it's for all time. But rather we've come to accept that there are ongoing genetic sequences of systems in theology. And there will be permanent achievements in some of those that will be passed on to future theologies. And that's our task today as we look to the past. All right, what are the permanent achievements in systematic achievements of the past? And then when we write our own, we have to be mindful of the fact that ours will also be superseded by people who come after us. And so whatever we do, we have to know, we have to realize it's the whole business of system will always give rise to questions that can't be answered by the system. And at that point, the system has to give way to a new and more inclusive, and that will take time. So that's the technical language, theoretical differentiation. And he speaks here of three different contexts for that. The metaphysical, that's Aristotle, empirical science, modern science, transcendental, his own work. There's a system, you know, a system of experience, understanding, judgment, decision. That's all very systematic, the relationships of those things to each other. And then there's a post-systematic differentiation, in the sense that I dare say that no one of the six of us could speak for more than a few minutes about relativity, for instance, Einstein's relativity. But it has affected our everyday existence in this world. It's by osmosis we've picked it up. We're living in a four-dimensional space-time universe. So that's post-systematic. It's come down to us. But I couldn't tell you what it is. I mean, I can write E equals MC squared on the board, and I know what each of those figures means, but that's about as far as I can go in actually really explaining it. So I'm not in it, and yet it has influenced me in the sense that it's changed the vision. Or, you know, the whole thing, we're not living in a mechanistic clockwork orange universe. Okay, but 2 centuries ago, people thought they were. But science, modern physics, quantum theory, indeterminism, and so on, we now have chaos theory, We know that that isn't it. But how much can I talk about chaos theory or quantum mechanics? Very little, but it's seeped into our everyday consciousness. And then the religious differentiation, which is the one that is the most important for the present. Now, how much do I need to do with this number 5 of going through all of those? I'm not sure. I don't think much. I think I've said most of what needs to do to be said. So let's go to page 3, number 6. Yes.
I have a question about that section before proceed.
Yes.
Well, have others read Method in Theology, a chapter on meaning? Okay, so I see this very closely linked to the stages of meaning articulated in Method.
Right.
If somebody's in the common sense stage historically, their envisagement of God is going to be one that's... well, there's going to be personification. It's going to use images that are familiar.
Right.
Now, let's take the ancient Israelite context as an example of a common sense stage of meaning.
Mm-hmm.
People in that stage have not distinguished between momentum and weight and mass, which is inexperienceable. So, but the Jews have had religious conversion. So it's possible to have religious conversion without intellectual conversion.
Absolutely.
These are devout people.
Absolutely.
But they haven't entered into the theoretical stage initiated by Aristotle of going beyond the sensible to identify the relations between things.
That's right.
Namely, mass is a great example of something you can't experience, but it's nevertheless real.
Yeah.
And that's Lonergan's point in invoking Eddington's two tables. They're both real, but they're just two different apprehensions. The former is in the common sense descriptive stage of meaning, and the latter is in the explanatory theoretical one. Okay. Now, Aristotle is an individual who discovered the unrestricted act of understanding in his own way by saying that, you know, that the unmoved mover only contemplates perfect things. Well, what's the most perfect thing? The unmoved mover. So that's what he thinks about. That's really the unrestricted act in a very early formulation.
That is right.
Now, Aristotle didn't have religious experience or religious conversion. But he did have intellectual conversion. So all I'm trying to set up here is to very carefully articulate the difference between Aristotle and the ancient Israelites. They're lacking intellectual conversion, but they've got religious conversion. Aristotle is lacking religious conversion, but he's got the intellectual. So how do we link Aristotle to the being in love that Lonergan says permeates history? Because earlier in the lecture you mentioned that anybody can really affirm the existence of an unrestricted act of understanding.
Well, it's not, it isn't, Lonergan says it's not really hard to prove it.
So is Aristotle, he is certainly loved by God. I'm seeking greater precision on the question.
No, it's a very good question.
Is he in love?
It's a superb question.
Well, I'm just wondering if this is where Rahner's anonymous Christian idea could come in, that someone could experience being in love, but not necessarily name it God, but still have the transformation.
That's certainly one way of moving in along the lines of what Jeff is asking about. I think of the contribution here that is made by Eric Vogel, whom I mentioned earlier, as an interpreter of what happened in Greece, in Greek philosophy, that he makes more sense to me. Now, I'm not an expert in ancient Western philosophy, but I did have some courses in it, and then when I read Vogelin's two books, the second and the third volumes of his Order in History. Second volume is called The World of the Polis, P-O-L-I-S, the city-state, and the third volume is Plato and Aristotle. And it's especially the third volume. He's going to distinguish within this category of what we're calling religious conversion. That's not Vogelin's term. But he will distinguish a twofold movement. And one of them is the anthropological, and the other is the soteriological. What Israel experienced was the soteriological. Israel experienced the direct entrance of God into history, calling a people into existence. And it was the through these major personalities like Abraham and Moses. But Abraham and Moses are figures that stand for the whole community and call the whole community to existence. Okay. Especially Moses in Israel history, as it's narrated at least in the Hebrew Bible. But the anthropological horizon is the horizon that is present in Greek philosophy, and it's an opening of the soul to world transcendent reality. And in that sense, it is religious. But it, in Vogelin's language, at least in his book, The New Science of Politics, which is another very important book of his, it's still waiting for a response from the divine. But it's already been opened by the divine. So it's already been opened up by God's grace to the world transcendent reality. But it does not have the same kind of sense of friendship with God. You don't find that in the world transcendent reality that Plato and Aristotle are open to, in the same way that you find the Hebrew prophets, for instance, talking about God saying to the people, "I love you and I've called you and I want you and you're my wife, I want to be married to you," and all of that kind of stuff, this intimate relationship language that God uses in the soteriological dimension. But if Vogelin is right, there is grace and revelation present, and if that's present, then grace has started this whole thing. And in that sense, this is religious conversion. It's the opening of the soul to this world transcendent reality. And that's what got the whole philosophical thing started in the West. So Aristotle is in love. But he might not, he doesn't have the language of grace, but, you know, even the Hebrew Bible doesn't really have any formalized language of grace. There are different terms that it uses and so on. You don't get a formalized language until you get systematic theology, and then Lonergan will trace very quickly the history from Augustine to Aquinas. All the, they didn't have it systematized or formalized until Aquinas. A lot of the issues of grace. Augustine had some of it, but he didn't have it all. So it's kind of an ongoing opening. You know? Is that helping?
Yes, very much so. And it's an ongoing is the perfect word to use here, because isn't it fascinating how one begins in the common sense ancient Israelite context, perhaps overstressing God's imminence, the familiar, and moves into the theoretical context with Aristotle, perhaps overstressing his transcendence in a maybe deistic way. The first mover is kind of removed. And then the crucial third stage of interiority seeks a midpoint between transcendence and immanence that Lonergan consistently argues for as a dialectical stance one can take.
That's good.
Well, thank you. It's excellent.
Now, let me go on for a little bit more about what Vogelin is doing there with his interpretation of philosophy and his interpretation of Israel. Both of these were movements out of an exclusively cosmological horizon, which is mythic consciousness, and where there isn't a movement there isn't an explicit acknowledgement of a world transcendent reality other different from the rhythms of the universe. The soteriological moves calls people out of that by calling the people out of Egypt. Vogler is saying God is also calling Israel out of the exclusively cosmological mentality and into history by freeing them from the fatalism that comes with an exclusively cosmological mentality, fatalistic kind of thing. But God is doing that without bringing them through any of this theoretical stuff. The theoretical stuff comes later. There's a beginning of it in the wisdom literature in the Old Testament, in the Hebrew Bible. But that's already been influenced by Greek influences, the wisdom literature. There's a clear influence of philosophy on the wisdom literature that the Jews by this time had come into contact with Greek-speaking people who had been influenced by their philosophical tradition and so on. So they start talking about wisdom and all of this. But on the other hand, in the anthropological, if it's God that's at work, and according to Vogelin it is, it's God calling out of the cosmological into the philosophical. And the soteriological only comes along later. You know, that when the recognition in Augustine, for instance, that philosophy can't save, but philosophy is what opened Augustine up to the possibility of salvation. So it's that kind of, those kinds of relationships. It is after 3, so let's now us go out and make noise.
We're so hungry, we'll have to work on it a little bit.
I don't really mean that. Let's take a break.